Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Zelenko Report. I'm your host, Brent Hamacek. And if I'm your host, it means it must be Thursday. Each Thursday, I sit in the Ann Vandersteel Chair of Journalistic Excellence and talk about issues that impact young people in this country. Before we start today, I want to mention that if you want to purchase Dr. Zelenko's Z-Stack, you can go to either zstacklife.com or mypillow.com and put in the promotion code Foundation, and then your purchase will help support the Zelenko Foundation. I think you'll enjoy today's show. We've got two great guests talking about how to reach and message young people. Tim Korshinov from Today is America and Jennifer Grossman, the CEO of the Atlas Society. So two different angles, but all focused on how do we connect with today's youth. So come right back after the break and we'll start with our guests.
Your own government has the power to activate a kill switch on all telecommunications, instantly shutting down all private phone calls and texts. An EMP weapon or solar flare can achieve the same result. Rolling blackouts or permanent power outages will also take out the power supply to cell tower antennas, rendering mobile devices all but useless. During these emergencies, how do you stay in touch with the important people in your life anywhere on the planet? The answer is the Bivy Stick at SAT123.com. The Bivy Stick is a two-way satellite text messaging device that uses a satellite constellation, not cell towers, to send and receive text messages. It works anywhere on planet Earth, including in war zones or blackout areas. In unpredictable times, the Bivy Stick helps you stay connected when it matters most. Visit SAT123.com to get one while they're still available. Nearly all the vitamin C sold at retail today comes from China, and it's made from genetically modified corn. Even though vitamin C is a critical part of immune support, it's also critical to know where your vitamin C comes from. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon and BrighteonStore.com. And we only sell non-China, non-GMO vitamin C. We then subject it to rigorous laboratory testing in our own food science lab, checking for heavy metals, glyphosate, as well as microbiological contamination. Only after it passes our tests do we encapsulate it and package it for our audience. You can find it at BrighteonStore.com. It's not the cheapest vitamin C on the market, but it is by far the most rigorously tested and honestly sourced vitamin C available anywhere in the world. Support your health and this free speech platform by shopping at BrighteonStore.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Zelenko Report. I'm your host, Brent Hamacek, and I am joined today by a very impressive young man and a good friend by the name of Tim Korshinov from Today is America. And there's a fun story about how Tim and I met. A couple of years ago, I had a chance to speak for the Liberty Forum in Silicon Valley. I still think that when they invited me, they thought I was somebody else, but in any event, because it's a pretty prestigious group. But we had a dinner beforehand, and I had a chance, Tim joined us for that dinner, and we had a chance to have a conversation. I was extraordinarily impressed. I'm somebody who had a chance, as people who watch this show know, had a chance to work with Charlie Kirk when he was just getting started. And I said to Charlie after I had met Tim that I thought I might have just met the sequel. But that actually does a disservice on some level to my guests, not because of Charlie, but because Tim is Tim. And his organization and what he does at a remarkably young age is messages young people with content that they're actually interested in. And so I thought it'd be fun, since in this show we talk about how to connect with young people, to have a young person who makes his living, you got it, connecting with young people. So Tim Korshinov, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brent. That was quite the flattering introduction. I've got quite the shoes to fill during this.
Right. Well, you got about 22 minutes to fill them. So, but you'll be just fine. So let's start by you telling everybody about Today's America and what you do so they have a sense of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Today's America started about 3 years ago, and the organization came into the mix to solve an issue and fulfill a niche which really didn't exist in the market before, which was influencers in the political space, specifically on the right. Over the course of the last few election cycles, this definitely got intensified in the 2016 cycle and 2017 cycle. Democrats in the left wing have used influencers, right? We've seen that from a micro scale, where that's like LeBron James putting Black Lives Matter on the court. Of course, that's during the later years, but I'm just giving an example. To singers, to Hollywood, right? They had these macro influencer infrastructure. With the development of short form content and social media platforms, regular people could amass over a very short period of time large social media followings, literally just using their phones. And so when it came time for the 2020 election back in 2019, the left was at full swing with this. And, as any regular people online, conservatives started speaking out. People started gaining traction, very young people, influencers, started gaining traction, gaining following, and we're a digital messaging arm for the conservative movement. And when Today's America came into play, there wasn't really a player organizing this messaging, organizing these influencers. And these people, Brent, I mean, they went through hell. They had, one of our influencers got shipped a box full of deer guts, and it just got gruesome. People doxed them, which for your audience means their address was posted online. They were harassed. I mean, it was just horrible. So Today's America came out of the woods to fulfill that market niche, but also to provide really kind of like a relationship-esque community for these influencers that were going through hell altogether. And so, the influencer model in the conservative movement that you now see with organizations like Turning Point, with PragerU, it was really pioneered by Today's America. And so, fast forward to today, Today's America is a for-profit media company, which has the largest influencer network ambassador program with around 300 influencers. And its mission is to take talented content creators and develop them into personalities, doing shows in Sirius, very similar to the style of the Daily Wire, but very much Gen Z focused. Lots of people don't talk about this, but Daily Wire and some of the other players in the movement definitely message more towards the older audience, especially towards the millennial audience. And so we've seen the power of the anti-woke economy with that generation, I would say probably done best with the Daily Wire. And so our goal is to do that for Generation Z. So that's what we're doing.
That's great. So, so many questions, because there's terms that get thrown around today, one of which is influencer. And so I'm wondering if you could actually tell people what's an influencer on social media and how do they differ just from somebody who's using social media?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so social media is obviously done from two sides. It's people who consume content and people who produce content. People who produce content on a consistent basis that do it in an engaging fashion and are able to amass a vast audience are considered influencers. So in our network in Today's America, an influencer is, we don't really have a floor for people to join because quite frankly, one of the things that we want to do is have very, very small influencers, because when you have under say 5,000 followers, people following you are pretty much your family, friends, and people within your geolocation. And so when you're messaging on a vast scale, it's important to reach, local communities as well. Especially in battleground states, but that's kind of a whole other tangent discussion. But an influencer is just anybody that produces content on social media in an engaging manner. And in Today's America, we don't have a floor for, following of that. I'd probably say on the lower end, we have people who have around 2,000 followers.
Got it. So if you're old like me, you're focused on, I made me clear my throat on that. Perfect timing. So if you're older like I am, you like to actually, read things and understand long form developed ideas. And it seems as though the world we're in today is focused more on short bites of information, short video bites of information, sometimes things that seem to be more about entertaining than they do informing. there's a lot of different assumptions in there and you know, things I've mentioned, but I'm wondering if you could speak to the kind of content that actually is resonating with youth mm-hmm. Through the use of social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's take TikTok because that's the perfect example of what you're talking about, right? Content is getting shorter and it's getting focused on entertainment. Young people, myself included, I try to separate myself from a bit of that category because I do on a daily basis have to personally consume kind of long form information. But people's attention spans are absolutely falling, right? Like content both between TikTok and Instagram, the most popular is video, and it's something called Reels, where it's no longer even a horizontal phone format. It's a vertical phone format. So you're just sitting there and swiping. And those clips tend to be the most popular ones under 60 seconds, but up to 90 seconds. And you know, in that sort of short form, the biggest challenge for us is to get obviously the explanation of certain information across. But the biggest formats and most popular formats, let's say on TikTok, are comedy, music, and dance. Again, the trio that's entertainment focused. And so now the challenge becomes from a political standpoint, is getting across, you know, very important information and messaging, but in a format that's entertaining. So I think you're exactly correct on that, Brent. It's becoming very entertainment and short attention span focused.
So how do you bridge the gap between mm-hmm. entertaining and giving people content that they want to see, and then actually on some level either conveying knowledge or generating an interest in people to go get knowledge? Because mm-hmm. you can't do knowledge in a 60-second short sort of entertaining video. So you've got to stimulate something. And I'm wondering what the trick is to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I really think that the pieces of content which are able to get mass traction and interaction with them, people quite frankly do make purchasing decisions off of social media, and that can be kind of a telling factor in people taking later steps, whether to acquire knowledge. In this case, my example is products, and go off of social media. Our goal with our company, with Today's America, obviously, you know, we do have an incredible social media strategy in the short form, but we do see trends of people getting off of, you know, just the, like I said, the 9x16 vertical format and going to watch the long form content that we're producing. And so I guess there is the trick to bridging it is just producing very engaging, entertaining content and having a very clear message on a call to action afterward. You know, there's a remarkable statistic that Gen Z makes purchasing decisions, not based on, you know, sponsored advertisement, TV advertisement, but based on influencer advertisement. And influencers are the most engaging way to get a short form message across, we've learned. So for my generation, at least, it's something that's engaging, that's authentic, and that has a clear message and a clear CTA afterward.
It's interesting. If I go back 20 years to when I was over 20 years, when I was running a sports nutrition company, one of the things we knew was more effective then, long before the days of social media, and there was the internet, but the internet was mm-hmm. in its commercial incipiency. One of the things we knew is that it was better having an athlete at a press conference after a game drinking our drink in front of the camera than it was having him do a commercial for the drink, because people mm-hmm. spotted that sort of authenticness in the use of it. It's like, wow, Donovan McNabb isn't on getting mm-hmm. paid to talk about this. Donovan McNabb just won a football game and he's drinking the product while he's being interviewed about it. And so that mm-hmm. that what you're talking about, that distinction has long existed. It's just sort of the format that's changed it to display it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about these influencers a little bit. Like I said, I have a ton mm-hmm. of questions and I'm bouncing around a lot because it's the way my brain works. how do you, for what you do and the clients that you represent, how do you choose or screen an influencer? You touched on the following piece. I get that if somebody's got two followers and they're grandma and grandpa, probably not helpful, but beyond just their audience level, What about who they are and what they're saying and doing? Is there a vetting process for this? Is there a way that you sort of scope them out to make sure they're appropriate to bring into your network?
Absolutely. So our brand voice at Today's America is, although it is somewhat politically focused, and we, the vetting process for that is we have a forum by which an influencer applies, and they're asked questions about their ideological beliefs, their stances, the topics that they like to talk about, ranging from, let's say, abortion topics to gun control topics, right? Just what their content is about. We have an internal process to vet influencers. But as far as the brand voice of Today's America, what we're trying to get across is really just an anti-woke entertainment for Gen Z. That's what we're trying to build. So anybody that falls under that category really could potentially be a part of Today's America. And we will be producing politically focused content with our influencers, but the goal there is more so towards the entertainment part than it is to the daily news production. There's a lot of companies which do a far better job at that than us, really. I know that was a little bit of an all over the place answer, Brent, but hopefully that addressed
it. No, it was pretty good. It was no more all over the place than was my question that preceded it. So with regard to young people and with regard to messaging them, the Motion Picture Institute, which was established a few years ago, has done a wonderful job of creating content that's not labeled as political, but they produce films that deliver a message where the hope is that when the viewer leaves the theater, they might orientate themselves towards a particular view. The film they did about school choice in Virginia, which was nominated for some awards, is a great example of that. Actually won some awards because it was just about one woman's struggle to get school choice for her child. And when you were done watching the movie, the hope was, well, gosh, I really believe in school choice, right? So it's almost a little bit subliminal. How subliminal or careful do you have to be in crafting the content that you have to influence young people without overtly appearing to be influencing them?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought up subliminal messaging, because I think one thing that the conservative movement as a whole does, I wouldn't say wrong in terms of messaging, but attempts to message young people in a bit of a wrong way is how they frame things and the language that they use. I use the word language very carefully, because I think it's very important. There's an influencer that went viral, very viral, took over the internet. His name was Andrew Tate. And the way he messaged to young people, these were primarily young boys, was if an older person was to say there's corruption in the government, he would say we're living in a matrix, right? So he's essentially getting the same subliminal message across. The government is corrupt. They don't have our best interests in mind, so on and so forth. There's a corporate element to control of the entire populace, but he's saying it in a way, we live in a matrix, which young people understand. So the language piece, I think, is very interesting. It's something that's very important in how we talk about certain things. That's in comparison to how, an organization that's more older and established would think they should be messaging to young people, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I'm going to shift now to platforms. And
sure.
One of the platforms you're a subject matter expert in the use of and is fundamental to what you do is TikTok. And TikTok's been making a good bit of news over the last, I'd say, 90 days or so, longer than that. But really, it seems to be getting focused within the last 3 months as we look at different entities and governmental units and so on, starting to forbid its use. Because of the China factor and a fear of surveillance and data being stolen and utilized and so on. I'm just wondering, how does what you're seeing, that's almost like the earth moving underneath you slowly as you see, a rising up of concerns over TikTok. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. Just in general, go wherever you want with that.
Yeah. I love that question. This is probably one of my favorite questions to answer. And I'm glad you brought it up. So before even the whole ban TikTok notion got put forward, I think it was President Trump and some other players within the movement stood up and said that conservatives should no longer use TikTok, get off of TikTok, it's Chinese spyware. Our stance is our company completely understands the national security factor to TikTok. But the big, I think the bigger factor here is the cultural war, which we're all fighting. And I mean that in the sense that we all agree, and everybody that I talk to that agrees with the banning of TikTok also agrees that we're in an information war. And the way information wars are fought is with content, especially when it comes to social media platforms, right? So if you think of it as all these different channels of communication with different audiences, say you've got the MSNBCs and the CNNs as one land, you've got Twitter's as one land, Facebook's as one land, Instagram's another land, right? You've got the older people on the, you know, the Facebook watching the actual traditional news channels, to some younger people, decision makers on Twitter, to millennials on Instagram. TikTok is where Gen Z is. And so pulling off young people that use TikTok and are conservative and message toward that direction, and not allowing them to produce content, which is essentially the ammo to fight this information war, on that platform, is very, very dangerous for culture. Because right now, you know, what's happening in the Senate, Biden is asking for the permission to have the ability to ban TikTok. We don't know what's going to happen, but what is happening is people, and specifically content creators, being disincentivized and talked down to, especially on the conservative side, for using TikTok and for promoting their, you know, ideological beliefs there. I have a little bit more to go into as far as the actual involvement of the government in banning social media platforms. I honestly think that it's blatantly wrong. I think that the last time the government got involved, we got Section 230 passed, and that's already been used to limit our speech and our freedom on social media platform via safety moderation. My personal background, I my family is Russian. I'm also a dual citizen. I'm Russian myself. I moved here when I was very young, and I hear right now from my family, the they can't access Instagram, they can't access any Meta products, no Twitter, no nothing. They have their own. It's a similar situation happening in China. And so I completely understand the national security threat, but I think the principle of setting government intervention in information consumption for citizens is a very dangerous one. So there's also that aspect to it. At the end of the day, I have to see, and as we get more evidence and as this whole situation plays out, I may change my views. I don't know if this is, the hard stance that I will take after more information comes out. But from a cultural standpoint, and from a a constitutional and precedent standpoint, that's how I feel right now. I think, yeah, I hopefully made myself clear.
You did. You know, and it's interesting with regard to what you said about TikTok and people using it and so on. You and I met because I was speaking at the Liberty Forum, and I was talking about being an American dissident. And one of the points that I made, and have made in my writings and made since, is that we need to work within the existing system in order to change and alter the system. So in this case, because we have to use the tools that are available to us. And so right now, TikTok being such an incredibly important tool to use to reach young people, if we want to reach them with good ideas and we ignore it because we object to it, if we move outside of that system, we lose the ability to effect a change in the overall system. So I think you use the weapons that are available to you. We've got just a little bit over a minute left. I want you to tell people how to find you and follow your group's work and all those good things, so they can start to pay attention to, by the way, in the case of Tim personally, folks, you're paying attention to an absolute rising star. In fact, he's already risen. He's just rising higher. So tell people how to track you down.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brent. Thanks for the thanks for allowing the foundation for the plug. You can find us on all social media platforms at Today Is America. That's our Instagram. That's kind of like where we primarily put things out at the moment. Todaysamerica.com is our website. We also have just appointed our new CEO, Bo Hines. And you can find Bo on Instagram, on Facebook, on any platform. Bo ran for Congress before, so he's got quite the digital infrastructure built out from that. Our website, the Instagram, is probably the best way to keep in touch with us.
Terrific. Tim Korshnoff, everybody, from Today Is America. Tim, I really appreciate you joining us. It's kept me young to have a chance to work with you and the organization over the last couple of years. So it was one of the best dinners I was ever a part of. So everybody come back after the, you bet. Come back after the break, and we will be joined by Jennifer Grossman, the CEO of the Atlas Society, and we will talk about how to message objectivism to young people. We'll be right back.
SAT123.com. They have put together a really incredible package: emergency backup communication systems, power systems. We've got sat phones, we've got solar panels, and also the big 400 watt solar panel behind us there. And why does this matter? Because of course, right now we are dealing with massive risk of blackouts, and the power grid is just failing, you know, intermittently, but it's going to get worse because we've also got energy shortages. Think about the lack of coal power, the diesel problems that are happening right now. If you're in the military or the National Guard or Border Patrol or law enforcement, and you need to be able to function even when the power grid goes down, or maybe you're a first responder, rescue team, firefighter, paramedic, you name it, you need to know about this equipment. So SAT123.com, folks. The global currency collapse will wipe out the dollar and many other assets, and the only things that will maintain value during the global debt reset are those with intrinsic value that do not require governments, corporations, or markets to make good on their obligations. At the top of this list of intrinsic assets is physical gold and silver. These precious metals have outlasted every failed civilization and government in human history, and they are non-digital, which means they still hold value even if the power grid fails. The Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals Company is my go-to source for physical precious metals that are delivered securely and discreetly into your hands. Visit BrighteonMetals.com to check their live pricing and in-stock coins and bars. Find out why they are my trusted source for physical metals and why they're the official sponsor of Brighteon.tv. BrighteonMetals.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Zelenko Report. I'm your host, Brent Hamacek. And this is very special for me because in this segment, we are going to talk to Jennifer Grossman, who is the CEO of the Atlas Society. A little bit of personal trivia here. Jennifer and her group were kind enough to allow me to present to the Atlas Society earlier this year and talk about objectivist ethics and how to live them and use them in the workplace, something I've been doing with varying degrees of success for a very long time, given my age. So I'm grateful to her and I'm grateful to the society. I'm, since my college days, an objectivist. And so here she is. Without further ado, Jennifer Grossman, thanks for joining me.
It's wonderful to be here. Please feel free to call me JAG. I was born in the peak Jennifer year, so I go by my initials.
I love it. And I do know that you use that name. I wasn't sure how to use it, if I was to use it properly in a recorded broadcast. So thanks for permission. I'll call you JAG, and the rest of the world can as well. So let's start big picture. And just for people who aren't familiar, tell them a little bit about the Atlas Society.
Sure. So the Atlas Society has been around for more than 30 years. It was founded by David Kelly. He's a Princeton-trained philosopher, objectivist, with a lot of work specifically in epistemology. He wrote the textbook on epistemology, Evidence of the Senses. He has also promoted a particular kind of brand of objectivism, open objectivism, which emphasizes reasoned, tolerant, non-dogmatic discussion and debate, a benevolent orientation to both allies, fellow travelers, and, you know, even people with whom we disagree, and also the belief that objectivism is open to refinement and expansion. So that is the history of the Atlas Society. The trustees recruited me 7 years and 3 days ago. They kind of gave me an opportunity to really bring my vision to the organization. And I had, curiously enough, been in the think tank space about, at the time, 20 years ago, when I had been the director of education policy at the Cato Institute, and then had spent the rest of that time in the private sector. And my big observation was that, you know, if you are in the think tank space, you are in the business of transacting ideas. And of course, digital technologies, social media has revolutionized the way that we can transact ideas at scale. And my observation as somebody coming back into this space was that most people in the think tank world were not taking advantage of these technologies. Things were being done pretty much the way that they had been done when I, you know, had been there all those years ago. So I thought, saw an opportunity to kind of innovate and update using new technologies. Also, the Atlas Society previously had been a little bit more academic in its focus. It had publications, it had summer conferences, but by and large, the people that were going to those summer conferences were people like you and me, right? They weren't the, the young people in their teens and in their 20s. I had also noticed, since I had have had a Ayn Rand on my license plate for all of my adult life, that some changes had evolved over the years. People used to look at my license plate, usually give me a dirty look, or, you know, just they would at least recognize who that was. And then I had noticed, that in the past 10 years or so, I just got blank stares where people would ask me, is that your name? And so I saw that there was an opportunity to, really a very positive opportunity to reintroduce Ayn Rand without having to deal with all of the negative priors that so many young people had, and just reintroduce her as a incredible, prolific, revolutionary intellectual, an artist, first and foremost, an immigrant, a woman. And so so that's a bit of what we've done. And, you know, now that we've grown to a place where I've accomplished a lot of my goals in terms of building out our dominant presence on social media and building a community of young people, we are now in a position to go back and offer, well, we've had our galas, of course, and that's an opportunity for members of the society to get together.
And they are wonderful, summer, by the way, having just attended in October.
Yes, and we're going to see you in Miami next October, but also this summer we are going to be returning to doing those more traditional kinds of summer seminars with a split between, 50 or so of our members, and then also that will help us to subsidize bringing 50 students in from around the country and indeed around the world, because the most exciting development at the Atlas Society that I've seen over the past really just 2 years has been this tremendous expansion internationally with our content translated into Spanish, into over a dozen languages, and the animated videos that will get 1 million views in English will get up to 8 million views in Arabic or in Hindi or in Portuguese.
It's wonderful stuff. And, you know, with regard to messaging, I had a chance a couple of years ago at the Heartland Institute to sit through one of the premieres of the graphic novel film you put together for Anthem. And I thought it was just extraordinary. And having read the book many years prior, and then to see the novel brought to life that way and in film, part of me thought going in, I'm not sure for me, you know, how captivating this will be just because of my age and I'd already read the book. I was mesmerized by it, and then sent the video to tons of people I knew afterwards. I think it was posted on YouTube, and said, you've got to watch this, right? It's extraordinary. But one of the things I do love about the Atlas Society is this notion of inclusion. There are let's just say, other groups that are a little bit more pure and dogmatic in their approach with regard to objectivism. I always like to joke with people when I speak that I come from a mixed philosophical background. I always say that I'm half objectivist, so my pronouns are I and me, and I'm half Catholic, so I feel guilty about my choice of pronouns. So because of that, I found the Atlas Society to be very, very welcoming. And so that leads us into what I really wanted to ask you about today, and that is at the Zelenka Foundation and through the Common Ground Campus program, we're finding ways to try to reach young people. And you're reaching young people or trying to with a message of objectivism, which people might not know this. When Ayn Rand was first kicking around what to name her philosophy, her first choice was individualism. And she settled on an objectivism. But we live in a time where students are from a very young age sort of indoctrinated to be altruistic and to be more Rousseauian in terms of wanting to serve the general will, perhaps, than being individualistic. So talk about how you bring this message to young people in today's culture and environment and using those tools. How do you get it to resonate?
Right. Well, first of all, I think you're absolutely right that young people, if they're going through public schools or even private schools, or just the general culture that is collectivist, right? You are Black, or you are white, or you are male, or you are female, or you are this gender, or you are that gender. Now, sort of with the kind of elevation of all of these, you know, neurotic conditions, everybody wanting to feel like they're special because they have something wrong with them. I think Ayn Rand, with her emphasis on individualism, but also her real heroic idealism, that, you know, it's quite a vivid contrast to this option of being a victim and just being one of the crowd. But how we do that, again, it was not just that I saw that no one in our space was effectively utilizing social media. But I also just saw that everybody was doing the same thing, books and lectures and white papers and conferences with more lectures, right? So I said, you know, Ayn Rand was an artist, and she herself said that art is the essential medium for the communication of an artistic ideal. She talked about art, mm-hmm. its power to transport, its recreation of reality according to the artist's values and ideals. And so I said, we can be different. We can do something different. So I also, wanting to go in that artistic direction, started to do sort of a sociological study of what, you know, where young people were generally, right? So I saw that these Draw My Life videos were going viral. Celebrities were using this whiteboard illustration that got speed ramped. They would narrate their life with stick figures really in about 3 minutes. And that was very, very intriguing to me. So I said, well, what if we did a Draw My Life of Ayn Rand? And this was back when we hardly had much of a social media following it at all. I was blown away that, you know, it just, you know, it wasn't necessarily to people who were following the Atlas Society, because at the time, 7 years ago, not many people were, but it got shared virally and had a million views. And then I said, okay. And that's one that I just had written and drawn myself and narrated myself in my, you know, little Russian accent that I do. But I said, then we're onto something. So then I started making it a little bit more specific. What if we were to take that and apply it to characters from Ayn Rand's books, or concepts like envy and victimhood, to places like Venezuela and Cuba? So that was, again, an example of saying, young people like this genre. Mm-hmm. What can we do with it? Same with the graphic novels. If you go into any high school or even college library, it's like, where are all the books? It's all graphic novels. So I said, and the Comic Cons are just a whole phenomenon, right, in and of itself, where people love to go and dress up in their costumes and meet with their favorite comic book illustrators. So I said, well, you know, are there any properties that we can adapt into a graphic novel format? Who are some of the most popular illustrators out there? Oh, Dan Parsons, you know, Inkwell Award winner. So that's kind of what we've done. So looking at the kinds of content that young people are in, adapting that, and then in some cases, kind of broadening it to draw in maybe people who aren't objectivists, but maybe they're more on the conservative side, or they're more on the libertarian side. And so a lot of our memes, they might be just a little bit more general about, you know, government or national debt, unsustainability. But then we always provide sort of a link back to where they can go and learn more about objectivism per se, going on platforms like TikTok, putting messaging there. So that's really been our strategy. But I think also this open objectivist welcoming attitude that, you know, we want to learn from them too. If right. you just go to somebody and say, I have the answers and I'm going to, you know, impose them on you, that's just not a particularly appealing consumer proposition.
Yeah, I've always felt, I used to, in the early days, I worked with Turning Point USA, and I used to teach their activists about persuasive communication. And I would tell them that the most effective way or when you knew that you were having a breakthrough with somebody in a persuasive conversation was when they would take, maybe put their hand up to their chin, tip their head, look up at the sky and say, I never thought of that. And I would share with them that in that moment, now you know you have them, because now their own brain is taking over processing of the things that you've been trying to share. And that's when you get that real conversion, which is the net leads to the next question. With regard to conversions, I'm wondering what sort of either general statements or stories or anecdotal stories you might have about young people being exposed to your materials and your approach and kind of saying, wow, this, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, this objectivism stuff is kind of cool. You probably got some success stories like that.
Yeah, I mean, mentioning Turning Point, I was speaking at one of their early conferences years back, and
our paths probably crossed.
Yeah, and so it was in Florida, and there were Antifa protesters out in front, and the Turning Point kids were getting up in their faces when, you know, anyway, something was not, they were having a bit of a not reasoned intolerant, you know, exchange. So I was there and I was looking, and a young man came up to me and said, you know, what if we started discussing it. And he had a ticket, but he didn't have like the full ticket. And so I said, well, you know, if you'd like, I'm going to their final dinner. I have an extra spot. You can come with me. And I talked to him a little bit about objectivism. And he went on to become completely enamored of the virtue of selfishness, and read it, you know, cover to cover 7 times. This is, you know, he was like a junior or something in college, African-American young man. Well, fast forward to today, he is just graduated from law school and he's taken the bar, he's clerking, and he's, you know, out there spreading objectivism, whether, you know, it's at a Comic-Con or in his workplace or the things that he does. And I've had so many stories like that. A lot of times at these conferences, particularly if it's a Turning Point conference, the vast majority of the young people have never heard of Ayn Rand. So we're there, you know.
I can attest to that, by the way. That's true.
Yeah, just half the battle is showing up. So, you know, I don't see any other objectivist groups going to Turning Point, but we'll show up. And, you know, it's a huge audience. And even if just a tiny fraction of them decide that they want to learn more, then I think that's a win for us.
I have a question to ask. And then if we have enough time, as I mentioned to you before we started, I want to switch topics if we have a moment at the end. But I have a question to ask. It's almost so complex, I'm not sure I can ask it, but I'm going to give it a try. When we talk about this approach that the Atlas Society has, that's more inclusive and sort of more tolerant of differing ideas, right, and synthesizing this as opposed to this quest for purity. Let's take the synthesized student who comes in with whatever they come in with, and we're going to insert into them some key element of objectivism to become part of their whole. What is, do you have something from objectivism principally that you would say, I guess, if you take nothing else away, take this and make it part of who you are?
That is a bit challenging because
it is. In general, apologize for the sneeze. There's nothing you can do on air with that. It just happens.
In general, I would say, rationality, but there are a lot of different, philosophies or, organizations or belief systems that would, just even straight enlightenment would emphasize rationality. I guess I would have to say that it would be rational self-interest, because that really, it's Ayn Rand's ethics that are the most revolutionary in terms of five branches of objectivism. And that's why I was, so pleased that that young man had really zeroed in on the virtue of selfishness to get them to understand the immorality of altruism, of sacrificing others to yourself, sacrificing yourself to others, this idea of the ennobling aspect of suffering. So I would probably say I want to, if I only get to talk to you about one thing that I think you might have a wrong idea about that you may want to consider, that would be the biggest leap.
I love the answer. I think that the ethics piece is so important. I tell people all the time that if we could follow an objectivist around, a perfect objectivist and a perfect Christian for 30 days without them knowing, and record every movement and word they made and said, at the end of the 30 days, we'd actually find their behavior to be very, very similar. And so I always say to people that, I'm a Christian by faith, but my operational system day in and day out is objectivist ethics, because it seems to me to be a little bit simpler to apply once you understand it. We only have a little over a minute left. I want a quick answer on this. Politics, objectivism, everybody's starting to talk about 2024 already. How do you reconcile being an objectivist with voting for candidates who, of course, will never meet objectivist standards? Give the struggling objectivist a quick tip.
Well, again, not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. A lot of times I would probably say that the last thing you should listen to objectivists on or who to vote for, because you looked at the last election and you had certain objectivists that were saying that you should vote for Biden over Trump, which I thought was absolute insanity. But they would say that I'm not an objectivist if I vote for, Trump as opposed to Biden. So, Ayn Rand, of course, was famously wrong in terms of her criticism of Ronald Reagan. But I guess at the end of the day, personally, I'd say what is the most important issue facing we are facing right now? To me, that most important issue was the gross, destructive violation of individual rights, the authoritarianism of the lockdowns. So I'll probably be making my decision based on which candidate gets it and showed the most courage during these past 3 years. Perfect. But it's personal. That's my point of view. Somebody else it might be an objectivist, and they might say, well, lockdowns, well, economy, well, socialism, abortion is the only thing. We must have a pro-choice candidate, and I'll be prioritizing that over all else. Well, I would disagree with them, but I think that's a legitimate point of view.
Well, thanks so much. On that note, we're out of time. Jennifer Grossman from the Atlas Society, Thank you so much for joining me. It's just a real privilege to talk to you. I'm very grateful. I know I'll get to see you around the political and event world. Maybe you'll come back again and we can continue this because there's so much we can do. But I'm very grateful. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Brent.
Bye, everybody.